One clarification that Jeff brought up, because we had talked about this yesterday, and that was about intentions. When I said that actions that you're judged by your intentions, that means an intention related to an action. In other words, what merely occurs to the heart, if it's evil, you're not taken to account for it. But if it's good, you're given a reward for it. So if a person has a good intention, but they don't act it out, there is a reward related to that. Whereas with evil, it's not. Like somebody cuts you off on the road and you know, I'd like to kill that person or something like that. As long as you don't go and do it, you're not taken into account for that. And unfortunately, people have recently started doing stuff like that. But now, just to relate to the qadr, people, this is probably one of the most misunderstood concepts in the Islamic tradition. I think a lot of Muslims even misunderstand it. But let me relate it to two very important concepts in the Quran. Generally, khayr is understood to be good, and shar is understood to be evil. But from the Islamic cosmological view, this is related to abundance, and this is related to want. And the actual moral component in these concepts is played down in a way that it wouldn't be in Christianity. So let me give you an example. I think for a lot of people, they have a hard time with the idea of a God who could create evil. And this is a classic philosophical problem in the West. If God is all good and he's all powerful, then there shouldn't be evil. Because if he was all good, he wouldn't want evil. And if he was all powerful, he could do something about it. And this is a common philosophical problem. They call it the problem of evil. And there have been attempts to resolve it. But from a Muslim point of view, we believe that good and evil are both from God. But before we say, you know, what, you mean God is evil, let's look a little deeper at what this means in terms of its philosophical implications. The word shar is related to, for instance, poverty. Poverty in the Arab tradition is shar. Why? Because it's a want. There's no moral judgment there in a poor person. You're not saying a poor person is evil. You're just saying poverty is shar. It's a want. There's a lack of something. When we talk about good and evil, from a Muslim perspective, good means that there is a divine presence. Shar means there's an absence of the divine. When you look at this in terms of a moral action, if a person saves somebody drowning, that would be called khayr. But if a person kills somebody, that would be called shar. Why? Because if you save the drowning person, there is a quality, there is a divine quality that is embodied there, which is rahmah. But if you kill a person unjustly, there is the absence of the divine quality, which is justice. You have been unjust. And the Quran says that God is not unjust. So in the absence of good, we have evil. And this is how the Muslims view it. They literally view evil as an absence of good. So to the degree that the divine qualities are not present in the world, we have evil. And to the degree that the divine qualities are present in the world, the immanence is present there, we have good. And this is why there is a hadith that says, the Prophet ﷺ said, Allahumma al-khayru bayna yadayk. Oh Allah, good is in your presence. وَالشَّرُّ لَا يَعُودُ إِلَيْكَ. And evil never returns to you. So while we believe that God has created a world of opposites, abundance, want, good, evil, we do not believe that evil goes back to God. Because evil is the absence of the divine. In other words, the divine is absent from the act. Now the other problem, when we look in terms of khayr and shar, is the Quran says, عَسَىٰ أَن تَكْرَهُ شَيْئًا وَهُوَ خَيْرٌ لَكُمْ. Maybe you detest a thing, and it is khayr for you. It's good for you. وعسى أن تحبوا شيئا وهو شر لكم. And maybe you love a thing, but it's evil for you. And then it says, وَاللَّهُ يَعْلَمُ وَأَنْتُمْ لَا تَعْلَمُونَ. And God knows and you do not know. So there's an idea here in this concept of good and evil that we are in a relative situation. We do not have all of the information here. That one person's evil is another person's good. One person's evil is another person's good. And this happens all over. You can see this. Somebody loses a job, another person gets the job. So for one person it was sharr. For another person it was good. And this is the nature of the world. Now if you look in terms of the giver of life and the taker of life, if there was no taking of life, then there couldn't be a continuation of life. This is the nature. We generally relate the taking of life to sharr. It's a want, it's a lack of. But in relation to the next world, there is a khayr, right? Because death in this world means life in the next world. So this is related to, we are not putting the moral components here, we are not judging things for ourselves. Now the Quran has given for the Muslims a criterion. It is evil to kill another person unjustly, and a person is taken to account for that and killed. In relation to the big picture, we do not know and we can't make an eternal judgment. We can only make a temporal judgment. We do not know. In other words, if somebody murders another person, and by all outward appearances it was an unjustly murder, that person is taken to account and his life is forfeited, or in certain circumstances, what are called the wulat ad-dam, can forgive him. Islam has an interesting attitude towards the death penalty. The Muslims allow for a family to forgive the person. So you can't, the Christian ideal of forgiving, and the Quran actually says to forgive is higher. So if a person killed another person, the family has the right to say they forgive them. Right? They can do that. But in terms of highway robbery, brigandry, there's no, that's anybody that threatens the security of a society, in other words, indiscriminate. So if there was a fight between two people and one person killed the other person, then the family could say, we don't want to take him to account for it. We're going to forgive him. They can do that. But if it's somebody who goes in and robs a store and kills somebody, then they forfeited their life by Islamic law. Uh-huh. A fatwa? Like someone listening? Okay. Yeah, a fatwa is not a death a fatwa is not a death penalty. It's a legal opinion. It's not binding either. In other words, technically by Islamic law, a person can give a legal opinion. Like I can give an opinion. You can come to me if I'm a faqih, a jurisprudent. You say, what's the punishment for somebody that curses the Prophet Muhammad? And you say, death. Right? So then I say, well, Salman Rushdie cursed him. Well, although that book is, what do they call it in literature? Roman Aklef? Is that what it is? Who's the... Roman Aklef? Is that what they call it? Yeah. Is that what they call it? Does anyone know the literary term? There's a term for something where you hide a historical or a factual thing within a literary... I think it's Roman Aklef. I'm not sure, though. Anyway, you know, for somebody to say, well, he slandered the Prophet Muhammad. Salman Rushdie would say, look, this is a piece of fiction. By Islamic law, that was completely unacceptable. In other words, you have to take people to trial. You can't just kill somebody. You know, Muslims we're not vigilantes. There's actually a procedure. And apostasy has, what's that? That's one way of looking at it, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the modern West, I think Norman Mailer actually during that time said, you know, heresy has made us free, long live heresy. In other words, there are a lot of people in the West that see heresy as a good thing. And it's interesting, this gets to this whole idea, because heresy in Greek, eretikos, means to choose for yourself. It's what they call the middle voice in Greek, the verb, heren, which is to choose for oneself. So I choose my own way. I'm not going to choose, you know, the way religion tells me or the way God tells me or the way. I choose my own way. And that is the original meaning of a heretic, somebody who chose their own way, who did not submit to. And in the West, we certainly have a tradition now, a post-Enlightenment tradition, which is really, we don't have to be subservient and submissive to a church or to some doctrinal authority, some dogma. That the individuals have a right to choose what they believe, to choose what they, how they want to worship, or how they don't want to worship, right? So that's very strong, I think, in modern Western tradition. And a lot of it is a reaction to the abuses of the church during the Middle Ages and you know, the burning of heretics and things like that. There was a lot of that that went on. Now, in the Islamic tradition, traditionally, heresy, there are laws of apostasy. I think they're a lot more difficult to prove, but there is a procedure. You cannot simply condemn somebody as a heretic in Islamic law. They have to be brought to trial. The intention has to be looked at, you see. So, but that's a case where, you know, politics is being used within a religious context. You know, I really... Oh, very much so. Yeah, because the Egyptians had a whole different reaction to it. Like the Azhar, they had a different reaction. So, you know, here was a case where... Because I'll tell you something about Muslims. Muslims take the Prophet Muhammad very seriously. They really do. And it's interesting that the Iranians also condemned the Greek author who wrote the Last Temptation of Christ. They also condemned him as disparaging a prophet, but that didn't make news. You see what I mean? So they were just across the board. You make fun of prophets, you're asking for trouble from us. That was their idea. Now that was true. There's still laws on the books in England, apostasy laws. There are laws that in England, but they did not relate to the Islamic religion, right? They relate to the Christian religion. So technically, there are still in certain countries, there are laws against, like in Greece and other places, there are laws against making fun of prophets, disparaging prophets, things like that. So a fatwa is just a legal opinion, and it's non-binding. It is non-binding. If Rushdie was in a Muslim country and he did disparage the Prophet, that by Islamic law, if he is tried and found to be guilty, that the punishment is death. That is a punishment for any prophet, Abraham, Moses, any of the prophets, not just the Prophet Muhammad. No, I don't think so. Because I think the Iranians have, like, they offered a reward and things like that. So I think, yeah, he does fear for his life. You know, personally, I'm not going to go out and hunt down Rushdie and things like that. That's not my business. My understanding of Islamic law is that it's not a vigilante law. I can't take the law in my own hands. So that leads to anarchy. Yeah, let me think about this societally. If I'm with some guy in private, And I steal all his money, blow him away, and then I tell the judge, well, he cursed the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Good alibi, right? You know, I mean, if you start thinking about it, it's crazy. You can't just, even, I'll give you an example. In Islamic law, if a man finds his wife in bed with another man, he cannot kill her? Absolutely not. He has to have four witnesses that see penetration. Pretty impossible, right? And I think you have to be pretty perverse to, you know, go into a room and try to, you know, see that. If people are under covers, you can't do it. Not just on top of one another. Seriously. And if the only thing he has recourse to is if he does find that, immediately he has to do what's called mula'na, which is where he goes to a qadi, he says, I found my wife in bed, and then the wife is brought, and they do what's called mula'na, which is a mutual cursing. Each one swears that the other is lying, and the fourth, on the fifth time they call the curse of Allah on them. If she does that, then she is absolved, but there's a permanent divorce, and the child does not go to his lineage. the child is not considered his child, right? If she doesn't, then she would be guilty of adultery. No, because it's related to lineage. That's the only reason. It's related to lineage. In other words, Islam is a patrilineal teaching. So it's one of the five things, and I didn't go into this, but it's very interesting. The five things that the Sharia is believed to preserve. The first is religion. The second is life. The third is lineage. The fourth is wealth. And the fifth is name, honor.
Sharia
law. So Muslims believe that these are the five things. Every rule in Islam can be related to one of these five things. So the reason prayer is prescribed, preservation of religion. The reason the prohibition for fornication, preservation of lineage. It is a right of a child to know who their father and mother are. That is a right. So fornication is prohibited. So in that type of situation, the best thing, you're supposed to veil people, right? If a woman accuses the husband of adultery, that does not relate to her lineage. She can ask for a divorce, perfectly permissible. She can go to a qadi and say, I have ground for divorce. And she can call herself what's called mutadarrira, and she can say, I want to out of this marriage. She is not supposed to say why. You see, the reason a woman is because of the lineage. If in other words, from the adultery, if there's a child as a result of the adultery, then it would be attributed to a man who is not the child of that man, and that is preservation of lineage. So the Sharia says that the man says, no, that is definitely not my child. And he has to do it right away. He can't wait like 6 months later and say, oh, I don't, you know, that's not my child. No, he has to do it right from the start, or else it doesn't stand up in court.
If he wasn't involved,
then she has grounds for a divorce, but she does not accuse him.
Why not?
Because it's related to lineage. In other words, accusing somebody of adultery is one of the worst things you can do in Islam. It really is. But the only reason that there is a situation where the man can do it is related to lineage, because there is inheritance. A child inherits from the man. And also the child takes the man's name. If it is not his child, then he does not want that child to have his lineage nor his name if he knows that the child's not from his seed. And that's the only time. And if she denies that, she is not condemned for adultery. But the child does not go to the lineage. She's not punished for adultery if she denies it. It's Quranic teaching. Mula'na. So the idea is simply lineage. You're not making a moral... If you see what I mean? The woman is not taken into account for something if she denies it. Her denial stands up in court. But the marriage is she's separated from the man, and the child does not go to the man. There's no adoption in Islam. There's what's called wakala, which is where you take care of a child, which is highly encouraged, but the child never takes the name, ever. It's prohibited. And this is because one of the things the Sharia came to do was preserve lineage, that people should know where they come from. And this is why women, it is prohibited for them to change their name in Islam. A woman does not take the name of her husband, because it changes lineage. Because it relates to, within any culture, you have honor that relates to lineage. A bastard in Islam is not the same as a child born in wedlock. Well, life is why a child is not aborted, even if it's a bastard child. Life is over lineage. He doesn't bear stigma. It's not on the child, it's on the parent. No child bears the wrong actions of the parent, and that's why the child is not aborted. If it was born out of wedlock, definitely. She goes under the category of Zania, which is a fornicator. Definitely. There's definitely stigma within culture. By the Sharia, the child is not supposed to suffer for it. But there's definitely a human failing here. You do have stigma related to it in Muslim cultures, but there's not supposed to be. If there are four witnesses witnessing penetration, and they have to be just witnesses, they have to be people recognized as upright in the community. It's impossible, I guarantee you. No, then she's punished. And there's a hadith of the Prophet Muhammad that a woman during his time came to her and confessed to her. And he turned away. And then she came here, she turned away. So she confessed four times. And then he said, "Are you with child?" She said, "Yes." He said, "Go have your child." She came back after a year, gave birth to the child. She came back and she said, "Fahirni, purify me." And then he said, "Go nurse your child." She went 2 years, she came back. And then she said, "Purify me." Because there's an idea in Islam, if you do a grave wrong action, not a minor wrong action, if you do a grave wrong action and you have the had punishment in this world, you're not punished for it in the next world. So what she was saying is, I don't want to take chances of being, whether Allah forgives me or not, I want to be certain that I don't have this in the next world. She said, "Purify me." The woman was stoned, and one of the companions said, "May Allah curse her." And the Prophet said, "Don't say that, because if her blood was spread over this city, there wouldn't be a wrong action remaining in this city." In other words, her tawbah, her repentance was so great, he was saying that her repentance was so great that this entire city would be forgiven had they gotten a portion of her repentance. Now there's another thing, if a person leaves the pit, then there's no stoning. For a person who confessed, if they leave the pit, then you have to cease stoning. Stoning, I guarantee you, is very rare in the Islamic history. Very few cases, really. If they get out during the process, you have to stop. In other words, a person can say, no, I changed my mind at any time.
That's unacceptable by Sharia. Yeah.
Don't stonings happen in Saudi Arabia?
You know, this is a gross, to me, this is a gross breach of Islamic law, what takes place there.
Okay, so it does happen.
Yeah, they do implement that, but it's a gross breach of, I mean, you can't just apply piecemeal Sharia. It's a total system. And within a healthy Islamic culture, those things are very rare. For instance, in Islamic law, you don't go alone with a foreign woman. Just, you don't. It's one of the things that is a condition within the society. It's part of the social contract. You do not, like, I would not be alone with a woman who is not either a direct relative or my wife. I would not go alone with her. Prohibited for me in Islamic law. And vice versa is prohibited for a woman.
What do you say go alone?
It means I cannot be in a room alone. That's not alone. You're in a company. No, you're not supposed to be alone with a woman. Absolutely not. And a woman is not supposed to be alone with a man. And this relates to protection of honor, so that you are not accused. Because what happens often is your intentions might be perfectly good, but somebody sees you coming out of a room with somebody, and they, big problem. And I'll tell you something, in our culture, this is a major problem. Sexual harassment, these type of things. If there are witnesses, you don't have the problem. When there are people when it's two people alone together, it's his word against hers. Right? The I believe, what was her name? Anita. I believe Anita. You get the the society split. Democrats believe Anita and Republicans believe, what was the other guy? And then the thing about it is the man's honor is tainted. Now, I'm not saying I tend to probably incline to believing Anita, but the point is maybe she wasn't telling the truth. Maybe she was paid by the Democrats to I'm just saying these are possible possibilities, right? In that case, here's a man whose honor is destroyed. Or here's a man who for the rest of his life people are going to scratch their head. Did he or didn't he? Do you see? So the idea of preserving people's honor is very strong in Islam. That a person has a right, it is a fundamental human right, it's a divinely given right that you have your honor intact. And you do everything you can to preserve that honor. One, you don't lie, you don't steal, you don't cheat. These are all things that disparage your honor and you become known for it. Which is one of the reasons why in Islamic law, if you see somebody do something wrong, you are told to veil their fault. Because if you expose people in a society, then the impetus for guarding their honor or for making tawbah or repentance is diminished. In other words, if I become known for lying, then people, even if I start telling the truth, people are going to still remember, oh, you know, that's the liar. So it lessens the power of the ability of a person to do that and diminishes the impetus. So. And then wealth, preservation of wealth, why there's no stealing, things like that. So these are the five things. Now, let me get, that was just a digression because somebody asked a question, but. They don't inherit. Good point. Yeah. An adopted child does not inherit. What do you mean?
How do they make their wealth?
Well, you're supposed to raise them and give them a job, you know, teach them how to provide for them. I mean, did you get an inheritance? A lot of people don't get inheritance. You know what I mean? The lawyers ate up ours. Because my family kind of got into a fight and ended up, you know, which happens. That's why it's nice in Islamic law. It's all portioned out. You can't fight over it. Six. The wife inherits it. She's one of the inheritors. It's related. I mean, inheritance laws are related to the Quran directly. The Quran determines what portions people get, and the wife does get inherit from the husband, yes. Not all of it, no. The children have portions as well. The man can give one-third of his wealth to whoever he wants. The other two-thirds are determined by the Quran. And it's interesting that a man cannot divorce his wife on his deathbed. If a man has an illness that is called marad makhuf, like cancer, where the terminality is probable, it is prohibited for him to divorce his wife as a way of kind of getting her out of the inheritance or something, fighting her. Prohibited. Now, Islam is very strict about inheritance. And one of the things, if you look traditionally, Hodgson points this out in The Venture of Islam, that Islam actually breaks down monopoly. The inheritance laws are designed so that wealth is not accumulated into one small individual. Like in the 19th century, I want to think about, you know, if you read Jane Austen's novels, I mean, that is a real theme in her novels, this, the injustice of women being completely disinherited in 19th century England. I mean, remember, this is the age of the Enlightenment. And here's women in 19th century England being thrown out of their houses because there was not a male heir to take care of them. They lost all their money or it went to somebody, the male. Right? This happened very recent in Western civilization. In Islam, the woman has a right to, she has a right to her husband and her father's wealth. She gets a portion of her father's wealth as well. And this is one of the ways that women became wealthy in Islam. There are many, historically, many women who had, Hani is a wonderful example. She's in the Cambridge Encyclopedia of Islam. There's a little section on Hani, who she married a husband, and she actually owned a factory, and then the husband claimed that it was his, like community property or something, and it did not hold up in court, according to Ibn Hajar. The judge said, no, it's her property. So, and that was, you know, 13th century. So, I mean, that's the whole other thing. We're actually on Ummah, because that's really related to Sharia. And what I'll do, inshallah, is when we do this section on the last hadith, I'll open it up to talking about some things about Sharia. Because I think Sharia is definitely one of the areas where there's a lot of misunderstandings, misconceptions in this culture. People see it as very primitive law. And so, I can talk about that and open it up to things. And another thing about the Islamic law is that there are many different opinions in the law. That the actual things that are clearly... there's no debate about, are not that many. Many of the situations, there is an allowance for the intellect to understand and interpret the tradition. But if we go back to this idea, khayr and shar, human beings are taken to account for the good they do and the evil they do. The Quran says, لَهَا مَا كَسَبَتْ, for the soul is the good that it earned, وَعَلَيْهَا مَكْتَسَبَتْ, and against the soul is the evil that it has acquired. So we are taken to account for good and evil that we do in the world. The Muslims, the Quran is emphasizing the doing of good actions. Now one of the words that it uses for this is حَسَنَات. And the opposite is سَيَّات. Hasanat, the real word is beauty. In other words, there's an idea that a good action is a congruous action. It is a harmonic action. That a bad action is, it is aesthetically unpleasing. It is cacophonic. It is ugly. That the human being by nature recognizes beauty and recognizes good. And this is the idea in the Quran. It says, وَهَدَيْنَاهُ النَّجْدَيْنِ, we guided the human being to the two roads of good and evil. That there is something inherent within the human being. Now if you look at this in terms of the animal kingdom, if when animals do something, we do not put moral judgment on it. If a snake bites and kills a child, we do not say it's an evil snake. I mean, people might do that metaphorically, you know, but they don't. There's not a moral component there. It's simply being itself. And there's this, Rumi tells a story about the turtle and the scorpion and the frog, right? They're at the side of the river. And the scorpion asks the frog, give me a ride across the river so I don't have to walk around or across the lake. The frog says, I'm not stupid. I give you a ride, you'll sting me. And the scorpion says, you know, that's ridiculous. Think about this. If I sting you, we'll both sink and drown. So the frog says, that makes sense. Takes him across. Halfway across, the scorpion stings the frog. The frog says, why'd you do that? He says, my nature. Right? So the idea then is that there is within the animal world natures that they cannot change. If a lion is hungry and it sees you, it sees lunch. It does not see you as, I'm going to do something really evil today. I'm going to go eat this poor person. It's just doing, fulfilling its nature. When a human being eats another human being, right? Like that guy Dower, whatever his name was. Yeah, Dahmer. There's something we say that is sick. Why? What is the difference between the lion eating the human being and this guy eating the human being? The moral component. We say he should know better. That's a breach of the social contract. The person has gone out of its boundaries. And this is very important because in the Quran, there's an idea of hudud, of boundaries, and that the human being is morally bound to stay within the boundaries and not transgress them. And the word in Arabic for an evildoer is fasiq, which comes from a root word when the seed splits. And it comes out of the shell. So the fasiq, the evildoer, is the one that splits the protective boundaries of the hudud. Now these are seen, the hudud of Allah, which are the sharia, the sacred law. These are seen as not simply arbitrary laws. Don't do this, don't do that. They are protective laws. From the Muslim perspective, these are laws designed to maintain integrity within the society. When the Quran says, لا تقربوا زنا, do not go near fornication, Why? It says because it's a fahisha, it's a perversion, wasa'a sabila, and it leads down a terrible road. So the idea is that, look, this is not simply an arbitrary law. There are consequences that are related to this transgression that will have wretched effects in your culture and in your civilization.
Femininity.
Femininity is not, there's nothing, it's not encouraged for a male, but a boon is mentioned in the books of fiqh, a feminine person. Somebody who acts effeminate is mentioned that it's undesirable that he leads the prayer. But there's no moral stigma there. You're not saying that this person is bad or evil. When that person makes a choice to transgress boundaries, now, see, the thing is here, the idea of impulse. You know, I don't know because I haven't been, you know, that's not my experience of the world, right? I've been attracted to the opposite sex. That does not mean that I don't recognize a handsome man if I see them. I think it's natural for us to recognize beauty, right? There's an attraction to beautiful people, whether it's a male or a female. I think that's quite normal. From the Islamic perspective, if there is an impulse, then what is demanded of the individual is that they suppress that. So, from the Muslim point of view, if a person does have homosexual impulses or desires, which obviously there are people that have that, the Muslims would say that is the same as having somebody having an impulse to steal. That they like something, they want it, and they desire to steal it. They have to say, no, I will not transgress the boundaries, that there are implications. And the implications, there's an idea within Western culture, that modern Western culture, that as long as I don't harm anybody else, it's okay. From the Muslim point of view, there is a harm when it emerges into the public space. In other words, as far as the Muslims are concerned, what people do behind their closed doors is their own business. That is not my area of judgment. If I see an effeminate man, I should not assume that he's a homosexual by Islamic law. That's not my place. If somebody is openly doing these things, that is what becomes condemned when there's an open breach. The same with alcohol. Somebody that makes wine in the house and drinks wine, that's between them and God. The minute they step out into the public space, then that is where the Sharia says no. Right? So in terms of Islamic law, what applies to them in this world is only what moves into the public space, not what's in the private space. But in terms of the next world, we believe that God takes people to account for the public and the private space.